God formed man of the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and he became a living soul. And then God planted a garden eastward in Eden, and out of the ground made the Lord God to grow every tree that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And then God taught man a lesson, saying, of every tree of the garden thou mayest freely eat, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil thou shalt not eat of it. For in the day that thou eatest thereof, thou shalt surely die. And then God made woman, and he taught her the same lesson. It must have been a pleasant life under the influences of that garden, and under the guidance of simple rules made by God himself. Life was peaceful and harmonious. But another kind of influence intruded itself upon that pleasant scene and tempted man and said, God doth know that in the day ye eat thereof, then your eyes shall be opened, and ye shall be as God, knowing good and evil. Now the rules that God laid down to those ancient parents of ours were clear and simple and easily understood. Adam and Eve understood those rules so well that Eve could give back those instructions to the tempter in the same words that she had received them. No, there was nothing wrong with their intellectual powers or their powers of comprehension. In a true-false test, they would have made a perfect score. There was no defect of intellect. The defect was one of morality and of character. And because they flunked this first examination that was given to man, they were expelled from the University of Eden. The basic problem is the same today. All about us are men and women possessed of keen intellects. Intellects that have been carefully trained, and yet in the presence of certain influences, yield to pride and to vanity, to selfishness, to covetousness, to passion, to lust, and to crime. Influence is a cunning and dynamic force. None of us escapes it. Life does not exist save in its presence. all about us at all times, consciously and unconsciously. We fall under the powers of influences, both overt and covert, that transform us into different persons, and we do not even know it. Our parents, our relatives, our friends, our associates, the climate in which we live, the health that we enjoy, and the health of those with whom we associate, our economic and social position in life, the languages that we speak, the conversations in which we engage. All of these, little by little, make us and change us. The things that we consume through our senses, the things we hear, the things we see, the things we feel, the books, the magazines, the cartoons, the slogans, the headlines, these too have their influence upon us. The spot announcements, the commercials, the plugs, continually molding us and conditioning our wants and our desires. The school that we attend and the teachers who instruct us or have instructed us. The newspapers, the movies, the stage and the theater, television programs. These too take their toll. The momentary contacts of the day that we passingly experience, the smiles, the scowls, the joys and the sorrows, the encouragements and the disappointments, the good fortunes of life and the bad fortunes of life, the laws of the land in which we live, and the flag to which we pledge our loyalty. These are some of the things that continually are molding us, changing us, making us what we are. The tiny threads of influence wrap themselves around us until often, like Gulliver, we discover too late that we are firmly within their grip. I can recall one morning while I was still a student in law school, one of our classmates engaged us in conversation in the hall while we were waiting for our next class. I can still see him and I can still hear him as he vowed, "When I get out of school, I am going back home, and I am going to make money one way or another. That is the measure of success, and I intend to be successful." To the credit of those who listened, those remarks provoked stunned silence. But that is the language of a dollar-centered culture in which we live. Today, during our lifetimes, there are more channels working influences upon more people in more ways than ever before in all of the history of the world. But few of those influences are based upon a high moral level. A mother explained to her child that she would be gone for a while because she would attend the funeral services for the child's grandmother. Said the child to her mother, "Mama, who shot Grandma?" On questioning the child, the mother discovered that this child had never conceived of death from natural causes. And she understood that children departed this world as a result of gunshot wounds, because after all, that's all that she had ever seen on television. Influence. It is making a strange generation of us, of our children, and of our grandchildren. Pride and vanity insinuated themselves into the life of Saul until his mind was distracted. Solomon, with all of his wisdom, yielded to the pleasures of the world until finally his heart was turned to other gods. Ahab sold himself to wickedness because an evil Jezebel stirred him up, and their son Ahaziah, raised in that household, walked in the ways of his father and his mother. There is an old Spanish proverb, "Live with the wolves and you learn to howl." Mankind has tried to curb and to harness and control most of the physical powers in the world, and he has done a pretty good job. He has been able to harness the rivers and make harbors more useful. He can harness the waves of energy, and he can harness waves, television and radio waves. He has been able to curb great mechanical powers. He can compound chemical forces and put them to fruitful uses. He has been able to tamper with the nucleus of the atom and to tear it apart and to release energy and guide those energies into sometimes useful purposes. He has been able to work with the elements themselves. He has done a good job of controlling and harnessing the elements and the physical powers. But what has man done in curbing and harnessing and putting to more productive use the great powers of the human personality? The question is not mine alone. Other people today are asking the same question, and particularly educators. Recently, the American Council on Education published its report, a report that was made after extensive study as to one of the problems that it considers crucial in American education. And that problem is the answer to the question, why is it that modern education produces the fruit that it produces? We look about us. We find that education has done an excellent job in training the intellect. Those who made this study after extensive study and then reported it did this work by going out to the campus of 20 different selected American colleges and schools. There they talked with the students, the administrators, and the faculty, trying to determine what there was, what there is lacking in the secular education of today. For the most part, I think that their report is instructive and helpful. In general, the report was an attack upon the aims of present education. It reported that today the aim is largely that of developing the intellect alone. The report frankly acknowledges that that is too narrow an objective. The report warns that in the future, unless institutions re-examine their goals and unless they adopt as their goal and aim the development of character in an affirmative setting of values, that we can expect no improvement on the product. In general, however, I believe that the concrete suggestions of the report are lacking. Rather timidly, it recommends that the goal should be a statement that instead of developing intellect, that the aim should be the development of intelligent behavior. And by the term behavior, they define that to mean wise and sound choices. Almost no concrete suggestions are made with respect to the ways that that can be achieved. However, the report does do, in my opinion, a commendable job in isolating six instruments for increasing the influence of education with respect to character development. And perhaps it might be helpful if briefly we will mention those six elements. First, to develop character, the institution must maintain a high level of expectancy. Students should reach, not beyond their reach, but they must learn to reach. They must learn to reach with respect to the material they study. After they have learned to critically analyze their material, they should develop a spirit of immersion in the material to the end that they may on their own develop a better ordered sense of ideas. But not only with respect to the material should there be the high level of expectancy. There should be the same high level on the campus, in the dormitory, and in the life on the campus. Second, to develop character, the institutions should carefully examine those who do the teaching. The reason institutions should carefully look at those who do the teaching is that is exactly what the student does. In questioning these students as to what factors most influence their attitudes, whether for good or bad, in almost every instance, the student named a teacher. It was a teacher who inspired and motivated a student to do things that he did not know he could do. It was a teacher who was the catalyst that moved a student into new and broader areas. It was a teacher who held up the hand of those students who seldom win the prizes and the awards. Third, to develop character, there needs to be an effective bridge between the material taught, the curriculum, and the lessons of character. There was some discussion with respect to values, but for the most part, nothing was recommended on how this might be accomplished. And fourth, there must be a balance between the productive energies of the students and the lessons of responsibility. And fifth, the overall climate or atmosphere of the campus must reflect the institution's goals. And here I should like to read what is meant by that rule. Mr. Houston Smith, in his The Purposes of Higher Education, explains that in this way: any college worthy of the name will have a spiritual life of its own, which makes of it more than an assemblage of teachers, students, and buildings. At best, it will have an atmosphere which is felt to be different from other environments the moment one steps into it, and which acts as a powerful developing force upon all who live within it. Such an atmosphere will be like mist, in the sense that one cannot put one's finger on it. But no one should be able to stay in it long without becoming thoroughly soaked. The campus must rub off good influence upon all those when they step up on the curb that leads them to the institution. And sixth, to develop character, there needs to be full opportunity, and this one interests me particularly because it comes from secular educators. There must be full opportunity for religious understanding, investigation, and practice. The report states that an examination of the American young man and young lady reveals that young people are interested in religion. They are opposed to hypocrisy. They want to believe in God. In all other areas of human curiosity, people have an opportunity to study a course which is treated with integrity and discipline and respect, save in the area of religion. And these educators say that this is an area that must not be neglected if we are interested in character as well as the intellect. How do we measure up against these standards? While it may not be necessary that we measure up to them, I think perhaps it might be of some interest to see where we stand with respect to this study, which is certainly a sincere effort on the part of some people to find out what's wrong with education today. What I have briefly given you this morning is an unduly condensed statement of a book, which is the fruit of many months of work by many people. In general, I would say that at the Christian colleges, those which we already have, we are practicing, are trying to practice those things which the educators are now discovering, and the things that they timidly suggest that we should do, we are affirmatively trying to accomplish. I would say that our goals have already been stated. Perhaps we from time to time need to restate them for emphasis, but not to change them. I am of the persuasion that Christian education, as practiced in the Christian schools and colleges, already has as its goal the cultivation and enrichment of the Christian soul and an educated conscience. We already have declared that our aim is to teach a personal responsibility to a personal God who has given us personal instructions in a divinely revealed book. I believe, and I am of the persuasion, that we accomplish these aims of character when we teach young people and when we remind ourselves that our aim is to learn the inspiration of the Bible and the divinity of Christ, who is the way, the truth, and the life. We need to maintain the high level of expectancy. We need to look at the teachers who do the instructing of our young people. We need to bridge the gap between the curriculum and the lessons of character. And what the secular educator is looking for, we, I think, have found is the instrument which provides that bridge. We need to have a balance between the productive energies of the students and the lessons of responsibility. And we need to keep the spirit and atmosphere of the campus carrying out and achieving these goals and these aims. And we need to provide a means by which the young man and the young woman may practice religion and may investigate religion. Yes, I think that we are at least trying. May I suggest to you this morning that it is no easy thing to get all six of these instruments together at one time and at one place. And it is even harder to keep them there. It is so much easier and more tempting to pick out two of them, say, and then to emphasize them occasionally. But I believe that you will agree with me that if Christian education is to be a potent influence for good, that it must be the aim of all of us to work in every way possible all of the time to reach as many people as possible through all of these effective elements. It occurs to me, and I believe that you will agree, that the occasional sporadic inspirational address, not followed up and not developed as a habit of life or a practice, has slight permanent influence upon the soul of man. If we have an occasional Bible course or Bible lesson squeezed into a curriculum that is already top-heavy, or if it is piled on top of student activities that are predominantly geared to the ways of the world, may I suggest that it can even have the effect of emphasizing the lack of importance of Christian education. An occasional, supplemental, half-hearted, or half-purpose effort, say through an annual religious emphasis week on some campus, I say that that is not the effective way in order to stimulate permanently Christian character. If a Bible course is simply another course in a sea of many courses, we miss our goal. I thought perhaps it might be of interest to us this morning, as a sample, to take a group of students who went out from this college, say, 25 years ago, and see what has happened to them. Let us see what the fruit of Christian education has been with respect to this one institution. And then we can multiply it 100-fold or more and see what the product of Christian education might be, what it can be. Those students who at this place fell under the influence of this campus and this faculty and this curriculum, what has happened to them? 68 students were graduated in the class of a little more than 25 years ago. Of that group, 30 of them are now teaching the young people of this generation. Two of them are superintendents. One is a president of another Christian college. Seven, or a little more than 10%, are preaching God's word. Four are farming and ranching. Four are accountants. There are two doctors, one musician, one editor, one lawyer, one engineer, one insurance executive, one director of a children's home, and 13 housewives. How many elders and deacons and teachers of Bible classes, and how many thousands of Bible classes they have conducted, I have not been able to determine. But I did determine that all of them are married and none has ever been divorced. The students of today, however, I believe, view the world more dynamically than we did 25 years ago. I believe that the students of today have lifted up their eyes and they see opportunities and they undertake things with a daring that we did not undertake. Of that class, so far as I know, none has served as a missionary. But in the intervening years, There are young men and young women who have taken their families and have gone to 5 continents, and they are now teaching in 25 nations. And one half of the missionaries of the church are ex-students of Abilene Christian College. During the last 25 years also, there have been many new facilities and colleges for Christian education. It is natural that those younger schools should turn to the older schools for their staff. The presidents and the deans of 13 of those new schools have been provided out of the growing sea of ex-students of Abilene Christian College. This, ladies and gentlemen, is the fruit of Christian education. We are expanding our borders, though we are probably not doing it to the extent that we can. There is a need for this kind of an influence. You and I are living through the days when mankind is losing his faith in the idea of an unguided, mechanistic world. I found the definition of a human being as it appears in one text prepared by Dr. Murray in his Explorations in Personality, and he defines a person made in the image of God as a discriminating, evaluating, assimilating, adapting, integrating, differentiating, and reproducing temporal unity with a changing environmental matrix. So despiritualized a definition of a person made in the image of God may have once been acceptable. But that bleak product has produced the fruit that we are talking about. Benjamin Franklin once wrote to Joseph Priestley how he regretted that he was born so soon, because he said as he looked into the future, the discoveries and the knowledge of science would add so much to society. And then he lamented, "Oh, that moral science were in so fair a way of improvement." The intervening years have not provided that improvement. There has probably been a degeneration of morals. Wars have increased in number, intensity, and horror. The per capita war dead is greater during our times than at any time since the rise of the Grecian Empire. Criminality and delinquencies, both juvenile and adult, have multiplied. The illiterate nations are no less intelligent than the literate nations, and criminals by average are no less intelligent than non-criminals. What about the days through which we have lived? We have produced the roaring 20s and the thrilling 30s, the fighting 40s and the furious 50s, and we are told to make way for the sexy 60s. My friends, we are still reaching for the fruit of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Maybe somewhere down the line, we ought to produce a decade for Christ. And I believe that we can do it. We can do it. If we will develop a sense of urgency to use the instruments which we already have at hand, we can do it. If we train up the young people in the way that they should go, we can do it. If we will produce one generation that knows how good and how pleasant it is for brethren to dwell together in unity, we can do it. If we will teach the students how good it is to know these things and to know Christ and to keep thy soul diligently, we can do it if all people will worship the Lord in sincerity and in truth. We can do it if all of the American homes and schools and churches will say to the American young man and young woman, come unto me, hearken unto me, and I will teach you the ways of the Lord.
The things that have been said have not only inspired and lifted us up here, but in my humble judgment, will keep on reverberating in your hearts unto an achievement in a measure greater than we can realize of this situation. We thank God for individuals who will think deeply and speak humbly but forcefully about these things. We're certainly indebted to you, Brother Pope, and we're grateful to you for what you have said and what it will mean to us as we think it over in our minds and make it a richer part of our life and a greater part of such opportunities and challenges as we have here in Abilene Christian College, as well as out in our various works in life. A few announcements seem necessary. Titus Chan, Chinese student from Hong Kong, will speak today at the fellowship luncheon at Arthur's Cafeteria. Go out North 6th Street West